Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota on Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit toyotaonnicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at lexusoflexington.com.
Welcome to Real Living. We are continuing a pretty fascinating topic, which is the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. Last time we were in the middle of kind of describing the way the church looks, which I guess if you've never been there, or even if you have been there, is always, I think, a topic of interest because it's such a layered, complicated structure. And now you've been there, I know, as well, Mary Lou. And I have too, and we've been a couple times at this point, and it's just, I remember the first time I saw it, as we were approaching it from the bazaar, from the souk, from the market, right. And it was, you turn left onto this little sort of enclosed square, and you see sort of a shabby facade of kind of, you know, beige-looking building, Romanesque, with gray domes, and that's about it. You know, it's like, you're like, well, wait a minute, where's the rest of the church?
Right. It's very difficult to tell the what it's going to look like inside from the outside. Mm-hmm. But the doors are the predominant feature in that square. And you really can't tell where those doors lead to.
That's right. And it's interesting because it's not like approaching St. Peter's Basilica, or where you see it coming for miles and right. There's a huge entrance and then you go through security and, you know, and all that. Instead, it's you go through these arches, and then inside we were just describing, I think, last time, what happens when you get inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Remember, we also discussed that the original Constantinian Basilica was built on a pagan temple, that Emperor Hadrian had covered the holy sites because he wanted to prevent the early Christians from venerating the site. So it was obviously always known to the Christian community where Jesus' passion had taken place, because the memory of the place, right, the memory of the faithful, sure, kind of always keeps it alive, right?
Right, exactly.
And so it was on this site, on the site of the temple that Emperor Hadrian had built over the holy sites, that Empress Helena, the mother of Emperor Constantine, located the relics of the Passion, including the relics of the True Cross, etc. And Constantine built his original basilica, which, however, was destroyed by the Persians in 614, and then destroyed again by the Muslims in the year 1009, and the present structure is the church that was rebuilt by the Crusaders around 1149. And so that's kind of the church that we see today, with some renovations, fires, disasters, invasions, etc. So the main thing that we said last time is that the church comprises the sites of Jesus's passion. So the hill of Calvary, Golgotha, right. There is actually, you go up some steps and you're on Golgotha. And then you go back down the steps and you arrive in the little burial place of where the Holy Sepulchre itself is. And we described, of course, the church, the little mini, you know, church over Golgotha, over Calvary. We had Mass there. Beautiful. Right. And then we go back down the stairs and we go back to the mini church within the church, which is what we would probably call the little edicule, or a little, it's a little church. It looks like a little shrunk up church, right, within the church.
And what surprises people as you go in there, as you're walking up the stairs to go to Golgotha, is the noise and the number of people that are in there. It's a very busy, vibrant place. So at times you really have to work on, you know, having that moment of silence and prayer and meditation, whatever you want to do, because there is a lot of activity going on there all the time.
Some would say it's even chaos.
I would agree with that. And you would think that one of the holiest place is the pinnacle of our faith, that it would be like walking into, you know, St. Peter's or some other churches where you can find these quiet spaces. That's not necessarily the case, depending on the time of day and the number of people that are there.
So. Well, even early, if you remember the last time we went, we lined up to go into the Church of the Holy Sepulchre to be the first ones in the morning, right?
Right, for Mass.
And we went there and had Mass, and we could hear the Franciscans having Mass. Remember how beautiful that was?
Yes.
The people who are responsible for that part of the Basilica. But even getting in line at like 6 o'clock in the morning or whatever ridiculous time that was, remember, it was chaos, even just with us, because they were the people who take care of the place. And then there was a couple of stray pilgrims. You remember that little Greek lady, the older lady who kept pushing her way through the line and like skipping the line and trying to be. She was determined. Like, she was maybe 4 feet tall. Okay, maybe four and a half, and all bent over. And she just put her head down. And she was, and we were first in line, like all 45 of us, right?
Right, right.
You remember that?
Yes.
And she's like putting her head down and just, you know, no, she's going to skip the line, and we are going to completely, you know. And so in the end, we just had to say, you know what, this lady's all about it, and that's fine. She can skip the line, whatever, because we weren't going to get into a fight, you know.
Well, and I remember with some hesitancy when you went over to where the cross was placed, and you can go underneath that small little altar area and place your hand in there. You only have a few seconds to pray at that spot, because there's going to be someone coming behind you. And is it the Greeks that have that chapel, because there was someone, Greek monk or someone sitting there who oversees you, who has the sourest look on his face as he watches each and every one of us kneel down to touch that particular
Going to steal something. Right.
Yes.
I know, it's pretty crazy. It's really amazing the difference between the feel of the Chapel of Golgotha, like when you go up and it's, the mood is kind of somber, and the it's almost like a different kind of expectation when you arrive at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. I was telling you about the little lady who decided she was going to be first. But you know what? We were like, you know, 6th and 7th and 8th and 9th and all that. First thing in the morning, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which is always an amazing experience, just to enter into the tomb. Do you remember that, Mary Lou?
Yes, I do. And it's, what's surprising is you go up to Golgotha, where Christ was crucified, and then you come back down the steps. It's a very, it seems as though it's such a short distance to go from there to the tomb, which is kind of surprising. But if you look at architectural or reproductions of what the city looked like and everything, you can see where it was, that was placed directly outside the wall. So the minute you went outside the wall, you were at Golgotha, and the tomb was not very far away. So everything is in close proximity.
Right, which would make sense. And so what I thought was interesting is you go in, it's just this little two-chamber building, and it's a pretty low doorway. The first room would be the room where the body would have been prepared, and the second room would be where the body was laid on a marble slab. Now, as you come in, the room that you, the preparation room, the first room, just has this container for candles in the very center, candles in buried in sand, if I remember correctly,
right,
to stand upright, where you prepare yourself to then go, and then it's hung with icons. It's a beautiful structure. And then you go into the tomb chamber, which is lined with marble, if you'll recall, and beautiful icons and those very distinctive Orthodox Greek and Russian Orthodox lamps, you know, that hang from the ceiling, etc. What I thought was interesting is that you know, you arrive in on your right, if you're facing the entrance of the little room, you have an icon which opens, which swivels, and then underneath you can touch the original, you know, it's the rock from the period of the crucifixion that has been unearthed, right? Remember, you can open that icon and then close the icon, put your hand on it, etc. And to the right, below you, there is, of course, the slab, the beautiful marble slab that covers the rock bench on which the body of Jesus laid. And it is this slab which is venerated by pilgrims. And I know you and I have knelt and prayed by that slab, which is just beautiful. But what I thought was interesting was the slab was deliberately split by the Franciscans in 1555, lest the Ottoman Turks steal such a fine piece of marble.
Yes.
Isn't that interesting?
Now, when they recently did that scientific research on this and they opened it up, they did confirm that this dates back to the Roman times, because they went down underneath that slab, and it, you know, it was a tomb. I mean, it was what it was supposed to be. So everything is being verified each time a scientific investigation is being done, it seems, in that area. Of all the different sites, it's proving that yes, this did happen, or yes, this did exist, or yes, there is proof that this occurred. And it's very uplifting, perhaps to those that needed the proof. I choose to believe what scripture tells me, that it, what they said happened, and where it happened, it happened. Mm-hmm. But it's very reassuring to know that as science becomes more and more sophisticated in the technology, that it simply reinforces what actually happened.
I know. And our faith does not depend on all this, as we know. But it sure is nice.
Yes. Yes. And I think, you know, the end times started with Christ's crucifixion, death, and resurrection. And it seems as though the closer we get to the end times, the more proof there is that Jesus existed and what is in the scripture did occur. And it's not just based on faith, which I choose to use, but also on the evidence that they're finding in all of these places. So it's all good.
So what I thought also was interesting, when you first go there, you understand that the edicule itself, the little building that contains the tomb, is under the custody of the Greek Orthodox Church. What I thought was fascinating was that they guard the front of the edicule, of the little building. Mm-hmm. But in the very back, if you go to the very back of the church, of the little, you know, building, the little mini church that contains the tomb, that is a separate territory. There's a mini little chapel on the other end, remember, which is about maybe, I don't know, 6 feet wide and, I don't know, 6 feet, I mean, it's tiny, but it has an altar, it has all the ornaments, etc., and that is the purview of the Armenian Orthodox. And there, too, you go and you look at this chapel, and there's this monk, and he's looking at you, and he's sitting down, and it's interesting.
It is. Well, there's lots of chapels in there. That's why it's difficult to maneuver and know where you are exactly, because you're always running into these different chapels and different bits of areas, because everything has been built on top of the original, you know, structure. It's a confluence of a lot of different styles and little chapels.
What I thought was interesting was that there are other three minor Orthodox communities. So we've addressed the Greek Orthodox and the Armenian Orthodox, but there are the Coptic, Syriac, and Ethiopian Orthodox communities that have also carved out little spaces in the church that is theirs. I will never forget being able to go up the stairs. As you face the entrance into the church, there is a stairway that leads up to the roof of the church and to the second floor of the church, which is not usually on tours. You don't really see it. And it is on that second floor that the Ethiopian Orthodox's church has the right to, you know, to celebrate their rights there, etc. And it's crazy just the difference in tone as you go up the stairs. We went up trying to go to the roof, which is where Ethiopian monks live in a kind of African village under certain domes, little mini domes on the roof of little sheds, right on the roof of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. But trying to access the roof, you go through the space that is inhabited by the Ethiopian Orthodox, and they were in the middle of a liturgy. And it, and the walls were frescoed with these crazy, I mean, I shouldn't say crazy. They weren't crazy, but to our Western sensibilities, they were... they were frescoes on the walls, very, very colorful pictures of Abraham and of the Queen of Sheba and of, you know, just a different take, really, or a different emphasis, I would say, on the Bible and on their place in salvation history. Because as we know, a lot of the Ethiopian Orthodox kind of claim their descent from the Queen of Sheba, you know, and Solomon, and, you know, and all that. So I thought it was very interesting, just that whole, you know, and then they being Orthodox, they use the iconostasis. So the liturgy itself is being celebrated behind a screen that that separates the holy place from the faithful, right? So I thought it was just fascinating. And then from there, you, as you cross this space, you go up another stairwell and you go onto the roof of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, where you have the domes, little mini structures, kind of rounded. They look like just minimal sheds where the monks, the Ethiopian monks, live. So how would you like to live on top of the...
Well, and they can't give up that space. If they did, they won't get it back. So they're going to be there to the end of time.
I know, but it very interesting how these monks live. You know, I mean, it's very primitive. I don't even think that there was. I don't know. It was just it was a completely different experience, I must say. I've been looking for pictures. I wanted to describe it to you. I think we took photos when we first went up there, but it's very, very different in ornamentation, a different kind of sensibility, but absolutely beautiful. But in any case, so there you have parts of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. And the thing that prompted us to talk to you today about this was, of course, the discovery of an ancient altar that was found hiding in plain sight. So leaning against the wall in a shadowy corner of the church is a big blank rock the size of a dining room table that invited. So it was a graffiti stone, basically. People didn't know what it was. And so even early on, they decided they were going to like scribble, you know, "Hi, Mom," or, you know, "I was here," or whatever. But in the recent restorations of the little church within a church, a Greek team of engineers and architects recently found, well, it's a huge, very heavy block, right? It's a 2-ton block. And they had to lift it to move it to go to somewhere else, right? They just moved it basically from one dark corner to the other. But then they realized that when they moved the stone, they moved the part that where the modern graffiti were, and they turned it to where there was ancient decoration. And they realized that intricate circles carved into the limestone with traces of marble and the rich red stone called porphyry. Porphyry, this was no tourist graffiti. If you've been anywhere, if you've been to the Vatican Museum, you've been to the Louvre, have you been to the, you know, whatever museum, you will be familiar with the ancient stone of porphyry, which was very well priced, like a deep red stone. And so therefore a very precious one. And they found that there was evidence of geometric patterns of the stone's design to a style popular in Rome in the 12th century. The use of four circles surrounding a central circle, all richly inlaid, was the trademark design of the Cosmati family, Roman artisans who worked for the Pope. And in fact, in Rome, there's the Cosmatesque floors that you will see, beautifully, intricately laid floors that you can see in many of the churches in Rome. So the Mass actually employed, when people celebrated Mass there, they would use that big porphyry stone for Mass until a fire in the church in 1808. And then at that point, it was buried under the new floor. So interesting how, and we see that in Rome too with St. Peter's and other places, when there are layers and layers and layers of interesting things, and that maybe in 1808, that stone didn't look that interesting, so they just buried it beneath the floor. But now, after renovations, we understand the incredible value and the discovery of that stone. And to see that that, in fact, was a Crusader-era remain.
And it's really not surprising if you're there that things like that could be hidden, because it's gone through, I'm sure, several renovations and repairs, you know, due to earthquakes and fires and different things that have happened over the century. So it's quite a find, and it's certainly an interesting additional piece to the wonderful puzzle of that holy place.
Well, if the stone does turn out to be something that was set up by the Crusaders, which looks like it probably was, it will remind the various communities that call the church home, so like the Greek Orthodox and the Armenian Orthodox and the Catholics, etc., of the sad history of division. And I must say, that's one of the things that comes kind of front and center when you do visit the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. You don't realize, really, the divisions in the body of Christ are quite so sharp and marked, and yet there's also union, because there's union in the veneration of the holy places. Everybody recognizes that those are the holy places, and everybody is worshiping and and venerating those places to the best of their ability, but they're doing so from a place of schism, you know, from a place of division, which is kind of sad. Now, the Crusaders were trying to reclaim the lands that had been taken over by Muslim invaders, but they also regarded the local Greek clergy as heretics and ejected Orthodox priests from the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. That's just tragic, right?
It is tragic.
So remember
what was going on at that time. We understand what they were thinking.
Mm-hmm. So to this day, Greek Orthodox, Roman Catholics, Armenians, Copts, and Syrians jealously guard their respective territories within the Holy Sepulchre, with the Ethiopians relegated to the roof, which I thought was kind of funny. As we just described. And there have been scuffles amongst the clergy. I will never forget our guide during our first trip to Jerusalem, as we approached the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and all of us are just awed by the, you know, this place and what it means, etc. And he points to the first step. Remember the first step of the staircase, of the outer staircase. So apparently one group, I forgot who is it who gets to take care of the floor as you enter the church. But then at the first step of the staircase is a different responsibility of a different group. But then the rest of the staircase is another. So like they're fighting on who will mop the first step as opposed to the second step as opposed to the main floor.
It's crazy, but unless you're there and you see it, it's hard to really visualize it, but it is very chaotic.
We would invite, here's a little plug for the Holy Land. You may have heard, you know, of course the news, they just delight in telling you about the latest rockets in Gaza and the blowing up of nightclubs in West Jerusalem, and they make it sound like a very dangerous place. Yes, the West Bank is a very dangerous place. Any kind of place that's ruled over by the Palestinian Authority, we can probably assume that it's no safer than certain darker areas in New York City, Chicago, New Orleans, etc. So what do you do to places like that? You don't go there. But what do? You still go to New York, you still go to New Orleans, you still go to Chicago, but you use your head and you stay in the areas that are safe. And the same thing with the Holy Land. The Holy Land, if you just stay in your lane as a tourist, as a pilgrim, and you visit the holy sites, is a very, very safe place. We have been there when there were rockets in the northern part of Israel, when there was like skirmishes, etc. And we basically didn't even hear any news about what was going on. We had people actually calling us from the United States saying, oh, what about the rockets? And we're like, what, are you kidding me? We can't, you know, we're in perfect peace. Nobody's right. bothered us, and it's all been fine.
Well, we went up to the Golan Heights on that first trip and, right. You know, felt perfectly safe. But what was so interesting was in the fields where you would see these, you know, cows and so on and so forth, you would see these signs not to go in there because there were still landmines there from the 1967 war. Mm-hmm. So it's you know, for me, the history is quite interesting of what's going on over there. But I never felt unsafe any place I went.
Yeah. So if you have an opportunity to go to the Holy Land, please go. I mean, we put enough trips on by now to know that people are afraid. You know, people are afraid, they hear the news, they don't know, they're kind of, I mean, you know, it's, in a certain way, it's kind of a lack of knowledge. But if you put yourself in the hands of a reputable company, there is absolutely no reason against and many reasons for you to take a trip to Israel, because there's really nothing like it. It's called the fifth gospel for a reason. It makes all the occurrences in the scriptures in the gospel come alive.
And that is the perfect way to describe it, because they do come alive. It will stay with you forever. You will be so grateful that you've gone, and it's something that you want to share with everyone you know and encourage other people to go, because it is where the Lord walked, and why not go there and see all the sights? It just deepens your faith and hope and brings a lot of joy in seeing the place where salvation history took place.
Amen. So go to the Holy Land and contact us if you want more information at cwbs.org. Thank you for joining us.
Redbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
We want to help others, especially in places of strife, such as the Holy Land, where Christianity is dwindling by the day. But how to help? Here's an easy way. Buying products through the Holy Land gift shop. Every product you purchase at myfranciscan.org/shop helps Christians support their families and stay in the Holy Land. Olive wood, embroidery, spices, and many more authentic products from the Holy Land are available right now at myfranciscan.org/shop. The Holy Land Gift Shop, bringing the Holy Land home.
I learned how many people we could help and how good you feel after you've helped others.
I know Lent is about giving, so I want to give.
These kids are talking about CRS Rice Bowl, a Lenten program known by generations of Catholic families. Children love it because they experience different cultures and gain a lasting impression of the people they are helping. You can bring CRS Rice Bowl into your home and experience the joy of seeing your children or grandchildren find new meaning in Lent. Visit crsricebowl.org to get started.
Rice Bowl inspired me to pray more and to pray for those who are less fortunate.
The Cincinnati Catholic Men's Conference is back. Tickets are on sale now for Saturday, April 28th at the Taft Theater at cincinnatimensconference.com or call 513-214-1534. The speaker conference roster is being hailed as one of the best lineups in the country. In rare appearances, come see Father Mitch Pacwa from EWTN, the man motivator Father Larry Richards, former Moeller High School and University of Notre Dame head football coach Jerry Faust, and the big celebrity keynote, Baz Rutten, UFC world champion, MMA world champ, and movie star. The conference theme is What It Means to Be a True Christian Man in Today's Society. Don't miss the incredible day of motivation, spiritual benefit, and fellowship with men from all walks of life. Get tickets now at cincinnatimensconference.com or call 513-214-1534. That's cincinnatimensconference.com or 513-214-1534. 1534. Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media. Find more about us at breadboxmedia.com.